lawn, throw a bouquet of flowers, whatever you want. What is on your mind this afternoon? I'm doing an open line show here. It's a beautiful, cool day. The campus is quiet because it's summer already. I believe commencement's already occurred. Graduation has happened. And the campus is on a summer schedule, which obviously is probably about a third, if not a quarter, of the students are here right now. But that does not mean that life ends, that the news cycle ends for sure. It's great to be here. It's great to be alive. What is going on in the world today? Well, we could talk a little bit about President Trump's foreign visits to Saudi Arabia, Israel, Italy, the Vatican, Brussels, and a U.S. air base in Sicily. I think the trip has gone quite well by any objective definition. You have former President Barack Obama trying to upstage Trump by traveling in Europe at the same time and giving speeches and talking. This is the same old rhetoric about how, you know, we can't build walls and we can't, you know, build borders, that as if this is somehow a regressive idea. And that, in other words, he's playing up to the internationalist world order elites, which is the top 1% richest people in the world, the millionaires and the billionaires, as Elizabeth Warren might call them, and the top political, economic, and influential, cultural influential people who are, and probably to a degree have always been, into this idea that there is something virtuous about moving toward a world order, a world colony, a world, turning the countries of the world into provinces of the world, and, you know, kind of tearing down what they view as artificial artifices, such as national borders and domestic cultures and, you know, the development of faiths and organized religions and what they embrace. And ultimately, property, the right to trade goods and services, and the right to be free individuals. They loathe that. You know, they view it, I mean, and I'm talking here philosophically. I mean, I know that even maybe consciously they don't. But, you know, they despise the idea of asserting national sovereignties. And that's exactly what Donald Trump is all about. So they will be at war with Trump and they will rail against Trump every day and every minute that he's in office. They will do everything they can to drive him from office. I mean, John Kerry, for example, talk about, you know, elitist, arrogant types. He spoke, I believe, at Harvard. I could take a look at the commencement speech, where he said these are not, quote, normal times, right? Now, what does he mean by that? I mean, I suppose it depends on what you mean by normal. For John Kerry, these are not normal times. We don't all stand around speaking with phony British accents and look to people who are supposed to be smarter than the rest of us to tell us how ignorant we are about wanting things like, you know, faith in God and our families and belief in that local government is there to serve us. We're not servants of it. That we believe in American culture, American values, American exceptionalism. We believe in preserving and advancing Western civilization and its values. That these are ignorant ideas. We're phobic. We're prejudiced. And that thus we're not in normal times because we're asserting those horrendous principles, what Hillary Clinton might have called deplorable principles. And so they continue on their march of, you know, against Trump. And from what I can tell, I mean, given the forces that are arrayed against President Trump, which are enormous, It's not just liberals. It's not just the Democratic Party. It's not just the left. But it's also the establishment establishment Republicans. The top corporations of this country and the world, the top 100 richest people in this country, the world, the elites of the world, that they have an interest in stopping Trump before he wakes us up to who we are. And given the power that they hold, I think it's safe that they're probably going to succeed. I mean, President Donald J. Trump has come a lot further than they planned or that they dreamed possible. And he has done a lot more damage to their international, amoral, atheistic agenda than anything to come along in a long time. So they have to stop him. And they probably will stop him. But because if he's knocked down and if he is stopped, my hope and frankly my prayer is that there will have been enough people who have woken up to enough of a degree that they will be able to step into the breach. He has advanced freedom. He has advanced freedom because of who he is, because he stands up as a man, because he stands up as an American. He has advanced freedom. He has not succumbed to the weapons of the left, which are now, it's almost laughable, but it's not because of the danger, but this sort of microcosmic, look at someone who might have something against someone else because they don't like someone's, ethnic background or racial background or sexual orientation or whether it's a man or a woman, more woman. So what they're doing, because these kinds of divisions have naturally faded, especially as we move toward literally a freer society, in which case those sorts of divisions naturally fade, because in a free society based on self-interest, based on belief in a creator of the universe, based on immutable laws, you're going to have a lessening of those kinds of divisions. Those are voluntary divisions. I mean, we're Americans first, but then we may associate with certain ethnic or racial paradigms, I suppose, or religious, which is our right. That's freedom. But we do them as a secondary question. We're Americans first. And as Americans who believe that we're sovereign citizens under God or under nature, if you're an atheist, which is fine, we are going to stand up not only for our own self-interest in our dealings, both professionally and personally, but we are more inclined to stand up for what is right as we look to objective definitions of what is right and wrong, things that are self-evident, as Jefferson might say. And we're also going to more likely call into action the part of our natures that does want to help our fellow man, that wants to help our neighbor. The hierarchy, if you will, the pecking order, and this is something that obviously not only exists in nature, but it's just simply a truth, is that we stand up for ourselves first, our immediate family second, our larger family, the clan, if you will, third, our associates, our professional friendships, our personal friendships, that's fourth, our community fifth, and our nation sixth. I'm using an informal paradigm here. But those are things that just simply exist in nature, and that as rational human beings who are created in the image of God and who can think rationally, we understand that those are the best means by which we can not only preserve our own freedoms and try to have a certain degree of control over our destinies, but that we can be in a position to help others and do. I mean, to the degree that America has been a free society, it's a degree by which we have helped other people and other nations and other groups who are involved with crisis. We are a generous people because that's part of human nature. That's not to say everyone's generous, of course. Many people aren't. But if we let human beings be who they are, and if we create for ourselves a freer society so that we can be free and sovereign under the Creator with limited power in this world, then we are more inclined to help others. The better side of our human nature is more inclined to emerge, even if it's just out of self-interest. In many cases it is, which so what? You know, we get something out of helping homeless people because we don't want the homeless people out on the street where they can be a danger to us. But we also do it because it's good, because it feels good. It is a normal thing to want to help another person. You know, I would tell anyone listening to this program to ask yourselves whether or not there have been moments in your own life where you did something kind to another person or for another person just to do it. And that there was a good feeling. There was an award for that. There was something that, you know, positive that you made. It made you feel like you, you know, you had made a difference in the world. And you had, perhaps, even if it's just a second, a minor thing. It could be something that occurs in a millisecond. If you do something that is good for someone else, that improves their life, you have improved the world, and that feels good. That's normal. We don't need the government to make us do this. In fact, the less government you have, the more likely it is you're going to do it. Well, to get things back to the topic here, that's what Donald Trump is all about. That's what he stands for. He is the individual man standing up to the tyranny of those who will try to force us to surrender our freedoms to the point where they're taking out a microscope and looking into our soul. Well, they don't believe in a soul, probably, but they're looking into our cells to see if they can find something in there that might not comport to what they view as an appropriate way to be. And if they do find that cell, they're going to roll it up the flagpole and expose it if you're not with them. This is a power play. This is what microaggressions are all about. You know, this is it actually shows how far we've come as a society in terms of getting rid of the real racism that we've had, that we have to resort to this sort of thing, where we now have so-called experts come out and try to tell people how to go under the microscope and think about every little nuance, and you did this, and you moved that way, and you look here, and you did that. And then they have this insanity called cultural appropriations. I mean, in other words, if you wear a certain kind of style, or if you put on a certain cut of your blazer, or a certain kind of tie, or a certain kind of dress, or a certain kind of earring, or a certain hairstyle, then you can be accused of appropriating that from another culture. In other words, stealing it. Appropriation is just a fancy way of saying stealing. As if the other culture somehow owns it. And what is it? You know, I get the fact that there are social pressures. I mean, I remember years ago, my wife got me, she was at some kind of a conference, and she came back and she brought me back a dashiki, which is African. And I decided just to, for the heck of it, I decided to go down to the town and wear it. And I did. And I got hostile looks from people. They're like, what are you doing? I mean, who are you anyway? You know, I appear to be white, you know, even though I'm not. And you're wearing this African garb. Now, I was wearing it in a way that was completely respectful. You know, I mean, I could get it if somebody was disrespecting someone else's culture. But the point I'm making here is that this whole cultural appropriation business is just another Marxist means of dividing us, of creating a dialectic of division, where people are taught to affiliate themselves with a particular culture because of the accident of birth, and to then come into conflict with other people if they in any way imitate that culture. The ultimate goal, of course, is to merge all cultures into one gigantic beehive, you know, where everybody becomes de facto equal. Anyway, this is WMFO, Chuck Morse. I'm live here, so you're welcome to join me. What's on your mind this afternoon, huh? 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636. I think I'm going to see about taking a... let's see if I can do this. A little public service announcement. Hold on. Let's see. No, let me just stop that and do this one.
It may be hard to believe, but people just like you are already saving money. FeedThePig.org makes it easy. Their simple savings plan teaches you how to start saving without going overboard. So you don't need to mooch off your friends.
You gonna finish that grape?
You mean the one in my mouth?
You don't need to stop buying the necessities.
What you're smelling is a natural musk.
Ew.
You don't need to be a medical test subject.
How do you feel?
Mostly okay. I... Sometimes, though.
You don't need to get a second job as a stuntman. You just need an internet connection. Don't get left behind. Start your personal savings plan with the tips and tools on feedthepig.org. That way, you don't need to sell your soul to the devil.
$15 is the best I can do.
All right, deal.
Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
Driving has a rhythm all its own. Don't wreck it with a text. Before you get behind the wheel, silence your phone. Or better yet, designate a texter. For more text-free driving tips, visit stoptextstopwrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
I am Dr. Lester Grinspoon, Associate Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. Back in 1966, concerned that so many young people were harming themselves through the use of marijuana, I began to review the medical and scientific literature to help clarify the nature of this harmfulness. Much to my surprise, I discovered that it was a substance remarkably free of toxicity. In fact, it is far safer than any pharmaceutical or recreational drug. There is no record of a single overdose death from its recreational or medicinal use. Marijuana is one of the most studied substances. I believe that it is high time that this country reconsider its stance on cannabis.
Them legalize marijuana.
We are back. By the way, I really don't agree with that ad. I don't mind saying that. And I think it was typical intellectual deception and indirection. He says there's no record of deaths or overdose as a result of marijuana. And that's true. If you take a look at that in its isolated context. But he did not talk about whether or not marijuana is a gateway drug that opens the door to other drugs. Now, I don't know if there's any hard studies that would indicate that it is, and my research on it is strictly anecdotal in that I've had conversations over the years with people, including a member of my own family and others, who became very seriously addicted to drugs and who had very hard lives. I know people back in the day who died as a result of drug overdoses, and basically, you know, they destroyed their lives. I mean, they committed suicide with drugs. And in every case, marijuana was the gateway drug. And in conversations that I've had with people, they've told me that marijuana was the gateway drug. So while marijuana may not cause everyone who takes a few puffs or even more than a few puffs to go into harder drugs, the people who do go into the harder drugs usually or more often than not, and I'm not saying this again scientifically, I think that it's sort of a reasonable conjecture, however, that they do start out with marijuana, and that there is a percentage of our population, whether it be genetic or behavioral or a little of both, and I would suspect it's probably a little of both, who have a predisposition to addiction, and that they should not be starting with marijuana. You know, so, you know, this sort of like, this is almost a glamorization of marijuana, plus the fact is that it makes you stupid. You know, I mean, I'm not against, frankly, a very select and specified use of mind-altering substances in certain circumstances. I'm not saying I'm not here to condone it. I don't. I'm not here to endorse it, and I don't. But I get it. However, it's not for everybody. And if someone is going to go there, they ought to take a look at their psychological makeup, their family history, and figure in a lot of factors, and then hopefully decide not to do it. To my way of thinking, legalizing marijuana, which is, by the way, an agenda in this country that goes back to financing from George Soros, is a way to make us more docile, to make us stupider, to make us more collective-oriented, and thus to tear down basic conventional and immutable understandings of ethics and morality. You know, I mean, this is why the left is pushing legalized drugs and legalized marijuana, not because they care about prisoners. I think we all agree that somebody who, you know, is caught with a nickel bag of marijuana doesn't deserve to serve time, and I don't think they do anymore. And if they do, then that's wrong. But that's not what they're concerned about. They're concerned about getting the country softened up emotionally, intellectually, morally. That's my contention. Okay. I wanted to talk about three things today. President Donald Trump and the Jews, the Trump budget as it was just submitted for consideration by Congress, and conversion therapy. So let me get to it. The first one I want to talk about here, Trump and the Jews. Donald Trump just visited Israel. And I think it's safe to say from his comments there that he is the most pro-Israel American president since Harry Truman, who recognized Israel in 1948 against the advice of all the establishment liberals in his cabinet and in the country. You know, he went ahead and did it. And for that, he almost is comparable to Cyrus the Great, who wrote an edict recommending that the Jewish people reestablish their commonwealth and rebuild their temple, and did so. President Trump has, you know, while he did not fulfill his promise yet to establish an American embassy in Jerusalem, and I think there's probably reasons for that that are not out of hand. It's a very It's an issue that has to be done with care and over time, although I personally think it should be done immediately, and I think it would not affect any, it would not lead to a war. Nevertheless, my understanding is that he did sign an executive order recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and as part of Israel, at least. And that's a big change from the past, where if an American was living in Jerusalem or visiting Jerusalem, they would, or something happened, they would not be considered part of Israel. They would just be Jerusalem. Recently at the Academy Awards, when Meryl Streep launched into that hateful, vicious diatribe against President Trump, filled with lies and innuendos, as if somehow President Trump, because he wants to assert American borders, this must mean he doesn't like people who are not white, is basically what she was saying. She then called out and congratulated several actors who are in this country who are foreigners or who are foreign citizens. And one of them that she mentioned was an Israeli, what's her name? I can't even remember her name right now. She played the role of Jackie Onassis or Jackie Kennedy recently. Maybe a caller might call and remind me. But anyway, she happens to be Israeli, and she didn't say she was from Israel. She said she was from Jerusalem, because she happens to be a Jerusalem person, citizen. And this actress called her out on that and said, no, I'm Israeli. So President Trump, by recognizing Jerusalem as part of Israel, that's a step in the right direction, both politically and, frankly, religiously. I mean, I'm speaking here again as a traditional Jew who believes that Israel is the footstone, is the footstool of the Messiah. You know, it's the it was King David's capital, and it was the site of the temple, both first and second. And as such, it was a place of special holiness for the Jewish people. So politically and religiously, I think it's significant to move in the direction of recognizing Jerusalem as the capital and as the center politically and spiritually of the Jewish state and of the Jewish nation. And I'm saying this, I believe, for all of mankind. And by the way, I should hasten to point out that the Quran, which is seen as the definitive holy book of Islam, has language in it, as does the Hadith, which I think is almost on par with the Quran, of recognizing Jerusalem as the center of the for the people of the book, what's called, which is the Islamic term for Jews. And that the people of the book are commanded to take possession of that city as a way of bringing about the Messianic era. So we could say that all three major faiths believe this as a matter of theology and doctrine. And politically speaking, it's an assertion of Israel as a sovereign democratic state. Now, this gets me to Trump and the Jews. I think that in the first part of this program, I talked about who Donald Trump is. And I think that who he is, or who he represents at least, or what his movement represents, let's even take him out of the equation, although I think he's central to it, is very much consistent with what it is to be a Jew. You know, the Jewish paradigm, and I'm going to be talking about this live, by the way, during the Shavuot overnight study, because it's a tradition in Jewish life on the holiday of Shavuot, which I think is a week from this week, next weekend, to engage in study and to bring speakers out to help study. And I've been invited to speak at a local synagogue, and I'm going to be speaking on this topic, Donald Trump and the Jews. So I'm giving a little bit of information here in advance as I work through my presentation, and I know it's a controversial issue because President Trump is a revolutionary figure. He's a controversial man and a controversial president. But my thesis is that a basic principle of Jewish life is God, family, and country in that order. God, family, and community or country. And that's what Israel stands for also. That's what Judaism stands for. And that's what America stands for. And it is those three factors that are the enemies of the secular and even, you might say, in the philosophical sense, the satanic left, which seeks to subvert those principles, since those principles stand in the way of their vision of a new kind of man, a collectivized man, a lobotomized man, where all people become de facto equal. There is no more property, there is no more God, there is no more family, and there is no more nation. And so by Donald Trump just being who he is, and by Donald Trump leading a movement that is consistent with Jewish values, he is advancing Judaism, he's advancing faith, he's advancing Western civilization at the same time. And Judaism, through its proxy, which is Christianity, has served as the underlying philosophical and theological foundation for the development of Western civilization, which I would argue is the most superior of all civilizations. Now, when I say that, I don't mean that in the chauvinistic sense that we're better than anyone else. We're not. I simply mean that because Judaism and Christianity embrace certain values that advance human life, they have created a better society, but those same values are available to any society and have been embraced by other societies to varying degrees, you know, including, you could look at certain tribes in sub-Saharan Africa historically, and they were just as advanced. It's not a matter of having like a superior, you know, view. It's a matter of asking all people to embrace certain principles that advance all societies and all nations within the context of their own sovereign existence and integrated into their own cultures. I'm not saying this in a hegemonic sense or in a chauvinistic sense. Judaism recognizes belief in God, belief in a creator of the universe and a giver of law, that the creation of the universe is divine. It's not some kind of a accident, you know, where different substances crash together dialectically to create species and all of these bizarre theories that the left has come up with over the centuries, such as the theory of evolution. But it was divine, that it was supernatural. It is out of our reach to understand it because we're not God. We're imperfect beings. We're images of God. So therefore, we cannot know these truths. We only can know what God wants us to know, what God has given us to know. And that is found, as a Jew I'm speaking here, it's found primarily in the Torah. It's a blueprint for what is. It's who we are. It's a blueprint for how we are to interact with other people, where we draw lines. You know, where we draw borders. It's a guide that it cannot be manipulated by the imperfect and corrupt hand of man, because it's divine. That's the Jewish idea, that we're created in the image of God. We believe in God as a lawgiver. He created us in the image of God. And thus we're imperfect, and we need to look to immutable truths. At the core, we're talking about existence, reality, as an objective idea. As, you know, reality exists. You know, and that, that this is something that cannot be moved. It's completely contrary to what the left believes, which is that reality doesn't exist. You can't know it, and it's, you know, everything is relative. Everything can be changed according to, and must be changed by people who are part of some kind of an illuminated elite who know better than the rest of us. People who look like John Kerry, for example. I don't know why I pick on him, but he just is such a classic example of this. And so we believe in God, and thus we derive our rights and our freedoms and our understandings from an immutable force that exists outside of nature, outside of the control of man, outside of the state. And this is articulated not only in the Torah, when God says that he created man and women in his image, but it's also articulated in our American Declaration of Independence, which says that we are endowed by the Creator, not by the state. The Creator endows us, which is beyond the control of the state, with rights, certain inalienable rights, specifically those being life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so Judaism and the American creed are consistent. We believe that rights come from God, not the state. We believe that rights exist, that they are immutable, that they are identifiable, and that we are to look to them, not the state, when we craft our own freedoms, our own lives, and our own destinies. And the other aspect is that Judaism is said to be very community-oriented, that we like to help each other and we like to help the greater community. And that's true. But as I said in the beginning of my program today, those things are natural to the human being. And the purpose of faith, the purpose of leadership, is to try to encourage those good tendencies, to organize them so that they can be more effective. This runs contrary to, first of all, the left's approach to these things, which is that we have to surrender our freedoms in order to make these things happen because they're not natural, and that you need the force of the state to make that happen, which is false. But that somehow by recognizing these values of the importance of sovereignty and of nationhood, and that man as under God, that we're not concerned with other people. I mean, this is literally what Barack Obama says said in Berlin yesterday, trying to outstage President Trump during his European trip. Oh, that we should be concerned not with drawing borders, but with protecting the value of children on the other side of the border. I mean, what a savage and vicious implication is in that. That somehow by our being concerned with our own families, our own sovereign existence, we're not concerned about other people? Is that really what he thinks? By the way, it's a whistleblower has released the fact that in 2014, Barack Obama knowingly and consciously gave a green light to gang members in Mexico under the so-called, you know, guise of them being, quote, children. Most of these children, or at least half of them, were you know, men. That he gave green light to let them come into this country, and he arranged for them to be dispersed throughout many communities. These people are hardcore killers. They're criminals. But putting that aside, President Donald Trump represents and embodies the values of Judaism, the values of Christianity, the values of Western civilization. And if we can wake up and recognize that and put aside the rancor, put aside the kind of tribal adherence to being well-liked and beautiful and all that, the selfish adherence, frankly, at least to ourselves. You don't have to be public. Believe me, you don't have to come out and wave your hands in the air and say, I agree with President Trump. I support him. I get that. I mean, I don't always do it. But if you can at least ask yourselves, to yourself, what do you value in your life and in your future, and appreciate the movement that he represents and why it's so important, whether or not he continues, why we need to continue to promote it for the sake of advancing human society, advancing our own lives, advancing humanity, then we're going to be a lot better off. Which brings me to my second point today, and that is the Trump budget. I was listening yesterday to all the radio talk shows and how they were attacking the Trump budget. It's cruel, and it's mean, and it's cutting people who are poor, right? A lot of this sort of class conflict, economic class conflict dialectic at play. And yet it's making rich people richer and this kind of stuff. It's become so accepted. Trying to create resentment. So I want to look at it a little bit. I'm not going to get into the specific numbers, but it does cut up to, I think, in the trillions of dollars over 10 years, government programs. Is that going to hurt the poor? Is that going to hurt anyone other than these millions of federal government employees and these industries that prey off of them? I think not. First of all, let's take a look at it practically. If you cut Medicare, or I should say, no, let's talk about Medicaid, which is healthcare costs assumed by the state with federal matching funds to help people who are below a poverty line, then you're going to be hurting poor people. No, I disagree. I think that you can cut Medicaid substantially without hurting anybody other than people who don't deserve to get Medicaid. Because I think that the Medicaid system has been allowed to accumulate a very high level of fraud. Now, I'm not suggesting that everyone who takes it is a fraud. I'm simply pointing out that there are a lot of people who are accepting Medicaid and other of these public charities who are scamming the system. And if we have in place a means to get them off of that system, then we can cut these agencies by 20-30% without affecting people who are deserving or who we want to, I don't know if I use the word deserving, but I would say people that we want to help. That's, you know, sticking to the original mission of actually helping the people it claims to want to help. Now, am I being mean and cruel by suggesting that? Let's put it this way. Like many of you listening to this program who are working people like me, you're paying taxes, okay? Now, I take money out of my pocket to give to the federal government and to the state government because I want them to do certain things with the money. I support the government. I'm not against taxes. But it's money that's out of my pocket. That's money that I earned. That's money that I would otherwise use to improve the life of myself and my family. You know, I have expenses. I have a child who's going to go to college. I have rent. I have to feed a family. I'm taking the money out of my pocket that I earned so I can give it to the government, and then the government is going to give it to someone who needs it in the case of programs like Medicaid. That's what we're talking about here. But I think that programs like that, like any charity, public or private, by the way, there is a social contract element to it, which is to say that if they're going to accept my money out of my pocket, they have to reciprocate with the understanding that they actually need the money and they're not ripping me off. I don't want to hear that they're scamming the system and putting my money in their pockets if they don't deserve it, if they haven't earned it, if they're, you know, they're not doing everything they can to improve their own lives. I don't mind supporting them. I want to support them. I don't want to see homelessness. I don't want to see hunger. I don't want to see elderly people suffering or, you know, disabled people suffering. I want to help them, and I'm willing to take the money out of my pocket, as are all Americans to a high degree. But I want to make sure that they are who they say they are. I want to know that they are not scamming the system, and I want to know that they are doing whatever they can in limited capacity to improve their own lives. If I can know that, then I'm happy to donate, and I would donate. And I want to improve our society. I want to do good. That's human nature. But if anyone's going to tell me that there isn't pretty widespread fraud in the system of Medicaid, then they're pretty naive. There is widespread fraud in all of these systems. First of all, there's fraud anyways, because there's always going to be people who try to take advantage. That's just the dark side of human nature. You know, that's why we lock the doors to our cars. That's why we lock the doors to our houses, because we know that there are people out there who will take advantage if we don't. They'll break into our car. They'll steal our car. They'll break into our house. You know, they'll rob us if we let them. There are always going to be people like that. So why should the government be any different? There should always be. This is just basic good government. This isn't liberal or conservative. This isn't Democrat or Republican, although Democrats might give this lip service every so often, but they don't do anything about it. Now we have a president who actually wants to do something about it, right? Oh, and they've gone into shock. They'll be starving. Nonsense. We're going to have the Department of Health and Human Services take a hard look at Medicaid and ask the state agencies to take a hard look at it. And figure out how to systematize it in such a way that we can get rid of the fraudsters. We can get off the payroll people who are not deserving. I mean, do you know how much money Massachusetts, for example, let's bring it to the state level, how much money we're spending every year on EBT cards, right? And then there are people who want to increase, you know, allow for lottery tickets, liquor. You know, those things are not essentials. That's not health. That's not keeping people from hunger. That's not food. Then on top of it, you've got a state legislature who want to turn this into a sanctuary state, which means it will become a magnet for illegal aliens who'll come in and also get EBT. And you and I, the taxpayer, are asked to take money out of our pockets, monies that would go to our families, and we want to do it. We want to give money to make sure that our fellow Massachusetts citizens are not going hungry. You know, but we do not want to be scammed. We do not want to be giving it to people. I mean, I don't know how far I should go into this, but there's a lot of scam. There's a lot of fraud in that area. And previous Democratic Governor Deval Patrick took a very cavalier attitude toward it. Oh, these are anecdotes, he tells us. I want to know that the government on the federal level, on the state level, on the local level is simply doing what good governments do. Weeding out the frauds and making sure that the funds are going exactly to who they should go for. That's all. Is that so much to ask? I believe that if we do that, and I think we have the means to do it, it's not that difficult, then we could cut these budgets by billions, if not trillions of dollars, and still effectively offer the service we want to offer to people who need it. We could also, in the process, cut out some of these layabout hacks on the payroll who are not contributing anything and who we're also supporting with our hard-earned taxpayer dollars. This is just good government 101. So if I hear people whining about, oh, there's going to be starvation, no. Also, we're moving toward a culture where by lowering taxes, which this budget also does, by reducing onerous business regulations, which this budget also does, or another aspect, we're going to unleash an economic behemoth. We're going to result, it's going to result in enormous capital at the source of its creation, which is with the imaginative individual creating goods and services. We're going to result in the creation of capital and the transactional dissemination of capital in the form of either consumerism or investment, both of which further stimulate the economy, further create more opportunity, create more jobs, create more everything, more creativity, more production. And that's going to rise our economy. So we will have less poverty. There'll be less need for Medicaid, because people can afford their own health care, especially if we get rid of Obamacare on top of that. By the way, speaking of Obamacare, there was just a report that came out of California where there was a study done in terms of whether or not California should go to a single-payer system, that being the government pays for everything. And it was found that it would cost so much money that the state budget would literally have to double to pay for that. And that's probably also would include the rationing that's inevitable to any government-run health system. Let me just finish this segment by talking a little bit about Obamacare. Now, let's go to the overall philosophical function of that system and what it really ultimately wants to do, which is government-run health care. I'm speaking here as an insurance agent. I have a license to offer life and health insurance in Massachusetts. So I know a little bit about it, not a lot. But what I would suggest to our listeners is that as imperfect as private insurance is, as bad as it can be, frankly, because everything is imperfect, and yes, you have some fraudsters out there, it is still a better system than a government-run healthcare. You're better off with private insurance if you have to go to the hospital, if you, God forbid, get some dread disease like cancer, and you need treatments and you need expensive hospitalization. You're going to be better off with a private insurance than you're going to be with government-run insurance. Think about it. If you have, I mean, just take a look at Medicare. Medicare is not what people think it is. There are very high deductibles. There's high waiting periods. There's rationing, and it runs out. And you've paid for that system your entire working life. That's your money, right? It comes out of your paycheck. It's called FICA, F-I-C-A. Read it. Look at your paycheck. That goes to Medicare. If you had private health insurance, even a minimal private health insurance for catastrophic illness, and you had to go to the hospital, you would more likely get care. You would be better off than if you had government insurance, in which case it would run out, it would be inadequate, it would be restrictive, and the hospital wouldn't be able to care for you, and you'd probably die. I don't want to think about how many deaths have occurred because of Obamacare already. You know, when you get socialized medical countries like Great Britain, who give you these wonderful sounding statistics, they're not including the number of people who have died. So, all right, I'm running out of time here, so I was going to talk about conversion therapy. I'll keep it very brief. I got an email from Congressman Joe Kennedy, who represents the district where I live in Boston, calling for the banning of conversion therapy. What is conversion therapy? Conversion therapy, I don't know, it's a formal thing, but it's probably also informal. It is therapy for people who want to who have same-sex attraction and who want to see a therapist to talk it through. They're not comfortable with it for whatever reason, and they feel that they need to have therapy. They want to look at it. They want to look at their past. They want to look at how it came about, maybe with the possibility of not necessarily changing it, but at least understanding it and putting it into a proper context in their life. They don't want it. They've chosen, there's something about it that doesn't agree with them. So they go to a therapist, all right? Now, apparently Congressman Joe Kennedy wants this to be banned. He doesn't think that people should have the right to get therapy for this. He thinks it means they got something against gay men and women, which is not true, by the way. I've interviewed, on another program, I interviewed a therapist, a psychologist who does conversion therapy. I wanted to get to the bottom of the story. And he told me, first of all, that there's nothing whatsoever that is coercive, because to try to force someone to have therapy is illegal and should be. And it's impossible. You can't make someone have therapy. What are you going to do, make them talk? If you go to a room and you say, we're now having therapy, I mean, it's like forcing someone to talk. So there's no coercion involved here. And sometimes those who want to ban it, they bring up, well, what about electroshock therapy and that kind of stuff? Most of that's been banned, and it didn't just apply to homosexuality either. I mean, it was somewhat popular after World War II and right up through the 70s, and was used by psychologists and psychiatrists for a lot of reasons. Very bad. I mean, I think we're all against that. It doesn't happen anymore, so it's not really an issue. And thirdly, this therapist told me that if he has a patient, a client, who is discussing their same-sex attraction, and they decide after a series of therapy sessions that they're comfortable with that and that they want to identify as gay, that he has no problem with that. Then he just simply recommends that they see another therapist, because his area of expertise is trying to help people, go through a process by which they might not necessarily no longer have attractions, which I don't think is really ultimately possible, but at least put it into a context. But there's nothing judgmental about it. They're not like saying, oh, you're sinners. There's nothing. That's not what this is about. It's simply that they seek therapy for this phenomena in the same way that you'd seek therapy for anything else. You're not telling anyone else what to do. This isn't any kind of coercion. Anyway, that reaches the end of the program, I can see. I want to thank you all for listening. Chuck Morse, every Thursday, 10 a.m., right here at Tufts University. Check out my books. I'm an author of about 50 nonfiction books. You can go to Amazon.com and put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, and you'll see them all come up. I also want to mention that the program is now carried by WBCA 102.9 FM in Boston, nonprofit radio, part of Boston Neighborhood Network. Thank you very much, everybody. Thanks for listening. Have a great afternoon.